Hey guys, welcome to CCW Safe Podcast. I'm Stan Campbell, co-founder and COO of CCW Safe. Today I have a special guest and friend here with us, Jeff Gonzalez from Trident Concepts. And he's one of our affiliates, and he's also co-founder of FTA. So we're going to talk about some few things today that's going to be important for you guys to know. Tapping into Jeff, he's been here a couple of times before. But we're going to talk about a few things a little bit different than what he's normally used to talking about. So welcome, Jeff.
Thank you, Stan. It's great to be back out here.
It's great to have you, buddy.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, it's the way I do it.
Yeah, so, yeah. It's the Stan Show.
It's the Stan Show. So first of all, got to give him a plug. Like, if you guys have not had a chance to look at this yet, check out Concealed Carry Guide by Jeff Gonzalez.
Yep.
A lot of great information in there. We had him come out and do a video series for us called Back to the Basics. If you would, you know, check out ccwsafe.com and look for those. For those who are new to concealed carry, it's a wealth of information, actually, for you guys when you get started in that world that we are in, which is concealed carry. First, let's start off talking about the book, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I'd love to.
The concept, where did it come from? Why did you decide, oh, you know what, back step, who are you? give me a bio, because there's some people that don't know you.
Sure.
You know,
I think that's fair.
Yeah, go.
Okay, so my name is Jeff Gonzalez. I am the founder and CEO of Trident Concepts. We're a nationally recognized company that's been around for about 21 years now, I can actually say that.
Mm-hmm.
My background comes from Naval Special Warfare. Spent the better half of my adult life on the East Coast and the West Coast, then as an operator and finished off as an instructor. I left the Navy, did the same job just for another agency, put in a lot of time overseas, and in that process, I stood up Trident Concepts. Mm-hmm. And we were very lucky because we stood up the company right about the time that the GWAT was kicking off. And,
okay.
and we just got engulfed with so many taskings of trying to do stuff that it became, you know, like an interesting time period to be in the business. Once the GWAT started to slow down, we kind of focused more on the private citizen, law enforcement. And about 2014, we brought to the public sector our low visibility operations mindset programming. And that really had to do with our guys that would have to deploy into, you know, non-permissive environments to do what we call battlefield prep. Basically, they are there surveying targets of interest, people of interest, that should we have to go back to that country, we have, you know, a record of their, you know, beings and comings and goings and things like that. So the guys have to be very discreet. They have to be very mindful of their surroundings. They're not able to fully kit up with, you know, everything in the kitchen sink.
Yes.
They're usually running very, very thin, very, very light. And the concealed carry aspect was something that was not very well established per se. Now, this program kind of came from my experience of a young SEAL having to be thrust into that same kind of environment in my day. And the problem was there was no training. There's very little practical understanding of how to carry concealed. Most everybody that was carrying concealed for a living, a professional, we're on the law enforcement side.
Gotcha.
Your plain clothes, your detectives, the UCs, those were the guys that were carrying, you know, discreet, concealed, however you want to put it. So we kind of had to create, you know, a start point for ourselves. And for me, it was like I was thrust into it. They were like, hey, you're going to be tasked to do this job. You know, here's the requirements. You got to be low key, you got to be low profile. And here's a holster for you to use. And it was the first time I'd ever seen an inside the waistband holster.
Okay.
It was the craziest thing.
What year was that?
Wow, this is going to date me.
That's okay.
It's about, I would say, like 90, 91.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. And it was a great time for me. But like I said, there was very little that even the senior guys in our community didn't really have a lot of experience carrying concealed.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that was done ad hoc. It wasn't a very formalized thing. So as I did that more and more, I created kind of like my own style of carrying. And I experimented with different things and tried a bunch of stuff. And, you know, I have a smaller frame. So for me, it's much more challenging to try to find that right combination, particularly for me, when at the time my carry gun was a SIG 226.
Yes.
Not a very compact firearm.
Correct.
to try to conceal on this frame. So as we, you know, as I did that throughout my career, I kind of just did that for myself. I didn't really, you know, it wasn't like I was tasked to do that. I just did that because I wanted to improve my ability to be discreet and carry and all that other business. And then word got out and a friend of mine found out about it and he asked me to come in and actually put that on for the group there, and which we did. And it just kind of snowballed from there. Mm-hmm. You know, we were doing it in the military circles for a while. And the irony was that we couldn't do it because it was a little bit unorthodox on a Navy range.
Gotcha.
So we had to actually use a Marine Corps range. So instead of being able to do it down in Norfolk, we had to go up to Quantico and use the Marine Corps base. And the HRP, which is the embassy teams, they were very gracious to invite us in there. And we gave them a free slot, or a couple free slots, I think. And what happened was one of the staff sergeants, Marine staff sergeants, transferred to Pendleton. And when he transferred to Pendleton, he called me up and he's like, "Hey, Jeff, can you do that program out here for me?" Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Sure, yeah, I'll come out there." Because I ended up going back out to Quantico to do a class just for them. And then he went to the West Coast and I came out there and did a class for him. But Pendleton was the same way. They didn't want any business with that. You know, it was very, again, unorthodox at that time period for range training in the military. And we ended up using a local law enforcement range and we gave some seats to those guys. And they were part of the, you know, like a street crime division. So they were plain clothes most of the time. And so they really liked it. They brought me back out to do it just for them. And the problem was, you know, there's usually competition for range use within the department. And so they couldn't get the range for use for us to do this training to coordinate with my schedule. So they just got a public range.
Yes.
We went to a public range and all these people saw what we were doing. And I got some people that came up to me and asked me what we were doing. And we finally said, "Well, this is what we're doing." And we're now in the public eye. So it was at that point that we started doing our concealed carry program in the private sector, which was about 2014. And we did it. I mean, it became almost 50% of our coursework for about 5-6 years. And we've trained just about every agency that has as part of the performance of their duties to be concealed. We've trained them all. And what ended up happening was we really kind of figured out how to do this on a broader scale for different people, all different types of backgrounds, skill sets, genders. It was one of these things that we really explored things. And I discovered that there wasn't really a succinct delivery vehicle to get that information without coming to a class.
Gotcha.
And that's really what kind of drove writing the book, was it just was like, you know what? Not every concealed carrier wants to come to a two-day class. And we know the statistics are very, very low that somebody that actually has a concealed carry permit will actually go out and train.
Yes.
It's a very low percentage. I would like for it to be higher, but it is what it is.
That's correct.
But many of them are also willing to invest in some research. They'll do some research online. They'll watch videos or purchase resources to be able to expand that knowledge base. And my hope is that when they read through this book, they become way more acquainted with the lifestyle, because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a lifestyle, and not a lifestyle that is detrimental to living a joyful life, which is the goal. Like I tell everybody, it's like, "Hey, listen, I want to live my life. I want to go do things. I want to see things. I want to have fun. And I just want to be armed in the process."
Correct.
Whereas a lot of other people will say, "Well, I'm going to be armed and I'm just going to be able to navigate only what I can when I'm armed," kind of thing. And you know, and those are two completely different mindsets. And the second mindset is somewhat limiting and actually pushes away a lot of people, because they feel like, "Well, if I don't want to do that, I'm not going to do that then."
Yes.
You know, so what I try to get across to people is that you can live your life and be armed in the process. You don't have to change your wardrobe. I mean, it's helpful, but you don't have to. You don't have to invest in all these crazy, you know, gadgets and doodads. You can just have a few things that work for you. And you end up creating a system that is adaptable. Mm-hmm. And that's the key thing about things, is like everybody wants to come to the table with just a one-size-fit-all solution. It doesn't work that way.
Correct.
And you end up, we as the industry, the instructor industry, end up pushing people away, or we end up shutting them out. Mm-hmm. We don't even invite, we're not in a welcoming kind of condition to bring all those people in. So the book was a way to kind of help bridge that gap, provide a very solid tooth-to-tail guide of the the art of carrying concealed, because that's also, you know, there's some science to it, but it's really an art. You got to kind of figure out what works for you. Mm-hmm. Here are some left and right limits. Go. Gotcha. Find something that works for you.
You know, it's interesting that, you know, I mean, you talked about who you initially rolled out to, you know, the law enforcement street undercover guys.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I did for 10 years on Oklahoma City Police. I had a street crime unit where we were undercover.
Yeah.
And you're right. I mean, there's so many different scenarios in which, you know, you just have to figure it out because, you know, I wasn't, you know, in charge of which car I got, you know, how my seatbelt was set up, you know, all the different things, you know, the clothes I had to wear to fit into the environment I was in.
Yeah.
Therefore, I had to change it up all the time.
Absolutely.
You know, just to fit the environment. But what I want to know right now is, you know, when, because you talk about, I mean, you know, in this industry, we run into, you know, many of your contemporaries, you know, you know, who have, you know, equal training, high level, you know, trainers, and not all of them know how to translate the information, no matter how much they are, their level of experience and training, it's kind of hard for them to turn that over to the civilian world.
Sure.
Right? You know, I mean, you have a gift where you're able to do that and, you know, be able to connect with these people.
Sure.
How hard is it when you have citizens, even law enforcement, sometimes military, where they want to be at that level, but they don't deal with, you know, the fundamentals? Because you do cover this in the fundamentals in here. So,
you know, that's a hard nut to crack because we are a... we're an instant gratification culture, society. Everybody wants it and they want it now. They want the cheat code, they want the life hack, they want the workaround or the shortcut. And, you know, unfortunately there are none. You know, it's, you know, like if you are, I try to relay this to something that more folks could probably appreciate. If you are, or a member of your family has to go and have a surgery performed, do you want your surgeon to be the one that took the shortcut, found the life hack, did, you know, didn't do the work to become a profession in his trade? And so, you know, if you're not willing to accept that for somebody that's going to perform a major surgery on a family member or yourself, then you shouldn't accept that for yourself as well in anything, in particular this, because this is a, this is potentially a life-saving, you know, I guess you could consider this to be a life-saving training event, or however you want to look at it. This is like your parachute. And so if you need it, you want it to work. That means that you have to put in the work. So the best way that I can tell people to kind of overcome that is the secret to winning is simple. Master the fundamentals and then execute them faster than the bad guy. You talk to anybody that's worth their salt, and they're going to tell you there's nothing advanced. There's nothing, there's no secret sauce or anything. There's just you performing the fundamentals so effortlessly that you make it look advanced.
Yes.
That's the trick.
Exactly. You know, thinking back on when we first met, when we were, you know, seeking partners, to roll out FTA with us, Firearm Training Association. When we met you, I'm like, myself, Mike, and Kyle, like we were seeking out certain individuals who has something to bring to the table. But, you know, when I think about you, you know, one thing that was higher on our list was not just your presentation, but your integrity, integrity in training, and how you, you know, valued things that you push across to your trainees. Give me a moment on why did you choose to partner? Because you too, you know, your reputation means a lot, just like ours means a lot to us. Why did you choose to partner with us? What did you see in CCWC versus some of the others that were out there?
So, I mean, that's a great question. I feel like one of the things that a lot of folks don't have an appreciation for is the complexities of the legal system as it relates to a defensive gun use. Even lawyers that practice this are still miffed by how it really plays out in the courtroom because there's so many unknowns and intangibles. What I thought that you guys did an exemplary job of is presenting it in a very clean and concise way. But at the same time, you brought to the table the leadership in the specific fields that mattered. So for instance, Don, I mean, when I first met him, so, you know, you guys had the credibility to talk about an actual defensive gun use that was tried in court and got the verdict that you needed, which was not guilty. When you look at a lot of the other insurance groups, at to the best of my knowledge, I mean, this could be different now because I haven't been paying as much attention, but there wasn't a lot of people that were willing to go down that road and actually see it to its end. And you guys fully supported that. So when I started to do my homework, I called a few of these other groups and I talked to them and I gave them a hypothetical scenario. I said this, I said that. I tried to solicit information. And a lot of times my information was taken down and I would get a call back, maybe a day, maybe a couple days. In some cases, I didn't get a call back, which was disturbing. Right. I told him that I wasn't a member, but I was interested in becoming a member, but I have some questions. When I talked to you guys, like right on the Johnny on the spot, I got everything that I needed. And it wasn't because of who I was. It was because of what you guys had set as the mantelpiece for how you handle this, which is, you know, you guys are going to go all in to support the victim of the defensive gun use, which in this case would be me.
Correct.
Right. You guys were going to be all in. Bring to bear all your expertise. Gary, who has, you know, so much knowledge when it comes to the actual, the initial, like, when the dust settles from the shooting. Being able to talk to somebody that has that level of experience. And literally, when you call that number on the card, you're literally calling Gary and talking to him personally. You're not talking to a switchboard that's going to take your number down. That type of service is really hard to express to people about the comfort and the calm that it brings you. Knowing that if you have the worst possible event in your life, the need to utilize deadly force to protect yourself or protect your loved ones, it's so nice to know that there's going to be a team that is assembled of the best in their fields to help guide you through this process and be there and support you.
Correct.
And to be there, not in just name only, but to actually be there with all the support mechanisms. I mean, we can go on and just do a laundry list of all the things that you guys offer, but I think it's important that the viewers actually do their research themselves and actually learn. Like, go and research and do side-by-side comparisons. There's a lot of great articles and videos that are out there comparing the two. And I think when the when you really do a good accounting of everything, it's really hard. It's really hard to I shouldn't say it that way. It's easy to see the difference.
Got you.
It's easy to see the difference.
And, of course, I'm not trying to make a commercial.
No,
but
of course.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, well,
One of the things that, like, you know, we pride ourselves on is, like, really being there for the members, number one. And like you said, like, a lot of these groups don't understand that it's not just about lawyers.
Yeah.
You know, you and I, because we are friends, you know, we had some conversation in the past couple of days, and like we even talked about our children and some of the things. You know, the challenges of adult children. And then, you know, like even stepped into, you know, like some of the things that, you know, we had, because one of the things you talked about was when you saw your first dead body.
Oh,
I remember when I saw my first dead body. And like a lot of the people who are out here, you know, who are concealed carriers, you know, who train to try to make themselves ready for that event if they get attacked and have to save their own lives. And training is amazing, but they don't practice or train the mindset of, you know, what to do prior to, like we, you know, you and I are advocates of avoidance and de-escalation,
of course,
because you really don't want to be in that thing. But at the same time, you know, they don't train for the aftermath of it because the reality of taking a life is a serious thing. Like, I mean, from the human side of it, speak on that a little bit about, you know, like, you know, really, you don't have to say names, but when you saw your first dead body, what kind of, you know, you talked about the two sides of the coin. Kind of make that.
Well, you know, like, so, in this case, I also would say this, that there is a there are three fights that you have to fight, right? Mm-hmm. The first fight is the fight to protect yourself and the potential to take in another human's life.
Correct.
Right? The second fight is the actual fight itself. And the third fight is the fight for your civil liberties and property.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You have to fight those fights in the right order. So the first fight is the most important fight, which is the prep. You've got to do the prep. Because the prep, being able to appreciate, like carrying a gun for defense is not, it's not as simple as just strapping it on. You have to follow it through its conclusion. You have to run it all the way through and ask yourself, am I willing to take another human's life? Now, in that sense, that seems like a lot of people will push back from it. Like new folks coming into the concealed carry world might have some reservations about that. But the way that I try to reword that is for to ask them, what are you willing to do to protect your life or the life of somebody else?
Correct.
The fact that I'm using deadly force doesn't mean he's going to die.
Yes.
It's an outcome, and it's a strong outcome, but it's also not a definitive outcome, right? There's still a lot of other things. So taking that on, taking that kind of burden on, that if I use, if I pull my gun and use deadly force, I'm, you know, I'm killing somebody. Maybe. I don't know. But what I do know is the act of defending yourself protected your life. Took your, you took your life and you decided to protect it.
Correct.
That's a huge thing. And I think it helps people to really navigate through a very difficult decision, which is some people will, you know, will have a hard time accepting that. And I tell people this is the time to have that conversation right now, because what you don't want to do is wait until you're in that situation and discover that you have some indecision.
Correct.
That's not the time for that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. So then, you know, you get into the actual fight, and we talk about avoidance is key. I preach the single greatest tactic that you can employ is maintaining the highest level of situational awareness relevant to the situation that you're in. And we talk about the color code and being able to navigate up and down, and always adjusting your focus to figure out what's really important, what's not important. And that's the one thing that I tell people is so very important as a concealed carrier. Because what we want is we want to be able to maybe not completely anticipate the bad things happening, but not be completely surprised by them. There's two types of events, right? There's what we call a boiling and a flash. A boiling is just as it sounds, right? Water's on the stove. It's kind of, you know, slowly simmering to the point where it starts to boil. So you, as the concealed carrier, can start to pick up on cues, pre-fight indicators that are leading to the potential for a confrontation.
Correct.
And that gives you valuable information that you can use to then help create, you know, strategy for how you're going to solve that. Am I going to continue to move forward? Am I going to move back? What is the answer? I don't know, but that information is valuable or invaluable in the sense of helping you to make a better decision.
Correct.
The flash event is an ambush. You were caught off guard, you were surprised, you weren't paying attention, and now, boom, you're in that situation. Those are very hard to recover from.
Correct.
And most of the time, there's no de-escalation in those things. There's
exactly.
There's a compromise, but there's not really a de-escalation. So, you know, you really want to avoid those flash events, and you want to try to avoid all events. But if you had to pick one, the boiling event is the one that you have more control over.
You know, just to jump in real quick on that.
Yeah.
I love the way you put it. I'm stealing that from you. But, you know, the in our world, you know, when we you know, defend folks involved in these incidents, you know, we talk about how, you know, like the flash events, not going to happen as much as the boiling events, right? So we're talking about your road rage incidents, you know, all those, you know, that, you know, the aggressive panhandler, you know,
my goodness.
Different
yeah.
things that start off being nothing, and because of the moves that you make, possibly, you launch yourself into this traumatic,
so true,
event, right?
So true.
And that there, the boiling events, is really what gets most of our members in trouble, you know, because they had an out. They could have created distance.
Very
they could
true.
Have, you know, not rolled down their windows or not gotten out of the car.
Yep.
Not move forward.
Yep.
You know, because a lot of times, and I always talk about, you know, when you have any type of conflict, or even at the start, the boiling event, when you have the conflict, to always enter into it, the same as if you would if you were not carrying concealed.
That's a good point.
So because a lot of people, they strap on the gun and all of a sudden the ego boost, right? And then they push forward because, I know that I can take a life if I had to.
Yeah.
Therefore, I'm going to push this forward.
100%.
You know, and they let this turn into this, and turn into something else.
So true.
So, you know, in saying that, like, I really like the way that you place it because we have to do our best to make people understand that, you know, it's mindset. Mindset to avoid the flash event, mindset to avoid the boiling event.
Yeah.
And then that all of those things will help you keep from changing your life because this is not the military, it's not law enforcement.
Yeah.
We are talking about in the citizen world where, yes, you have the right, you have the tools to do it, you have the training to do it, but once you pull that trigger,
oh yeah,
it's going to change your life. You own that soul.
So true.
You know, if you take a life.
So true.
Or just the legal stuff behind it.
I like a good way to kind of help people to understand that concept is that there will be a part of you that dies,
mm-hmm.
and there will be a new life born
mm.
from that event.
Mm-hmm.
And it is what it is. That's how it works. I mean, I'm not saying you die and your soul goes, you know, is forever damned. I'm just saying that the part of you that you were up until that point, there's a part of you that would have died at that moment.
Mm.
And now there's a new birth of somebody that as it moves forward, because that new person now has to navigate through a new environment, which is going to be all the legal system that has to throw at you.
Mm.
And it's a very convoluted system. It's not convoluted, but for the layman that doesn't understand it, it's a very confusing and intimidating system. So your best bet is to stay out of that system.
Correct.
Through that avoidance and through being aware of what's happening. And I think but there are times when there are no alternatives.
Mm.
Your last best option is to use deadly force.
Correct.
And so now you're left to dealing with what happens after the fact. And, you know, one of the things that I've been either, it depends on how you look at it, fortunate or unfortunate, is to have had several students involved in deadly force encounters.
Mm.
And sometimes I get a call very, very soon after the event. Other times it's after the legal dust has settled.
Yes.
But I usually will have a conversation with them and, you know, it centers around, you know, what happened, what was the outcome from the legal side, and then, you know, what did they learn? What were they grateful for? What were they happy about? Like, as far as like, I'm really happy I put the time in to train. I'm really happy that I was paying attention because I could see this happening a little bit ahead of time. And I mean, all of them will comment about how different their life is afterwards.
Yeah.
And being able to, and you know, one of the things I talked about in the very beginning of this conversation was the prepping of talking about, am I willing to take another life? And after you've done that, the reason why that's so important is because after the fact, you find out very quickly
mm-hmm.
who your friends are and the relationship that you have with your family.
Correct.
Because they're going to look at you differently.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. And so by having that conversation with your spouse in advance, saying, you know, honey, you know, if we're out and it's a choice between having to protect you from dying and using deadly force, I'm going to use deadly force.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want you to know that I'm willing to bear that burden to ensure that I can protect you. And, you know, that conversation that you have in advance helps you to navigate what's going to happen after
mm-hmm.
when you get into that legal system and when you're dealing with all the crazy stress and all the other things that come at you that you weren't prepared for. You have that connectivity prior that creates the solidarity that helps you to navigate emotionally through all that stuff,
mm-hmm.
right? When people don't have that and they find out really fast how quickly their friend list dwindles.
That's right.
Of
yeah.
sorts, you know, and then, you know, it's helpful to talk to maybe people that you feel, because you don't have to have this conversation with everybody, and I caution mm-hmm. you about talking about this to some people, but people that matter to you,
yeah.
people that are important, that are in your inner circle.
Yeah.
If there would be somebody that you would call in the middle of the night to come help you,
yeah.
they're probably somebody that you want to have that conversation with and say, hey, you know what? I just want you to know that if I had to choose between defending you and taking another person's life, I'm willing to do that. And I just hope that you will look at me in the same way that you're looking at me now.
Yeah.
That way you have that connection and that bond, because again, it's super important. And that's something that not a lot of discussion happens about how to handle post events and the stuff that comes afterwards.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like all that is another subject all on its own, but I know that these are the things that you need to do in advance to help you better navigate through the post-shooting and the fight for your civil liberties and your property. It's a tough one. You know, I've had conversations with enough folks to know that, you know, and it's hard to say with any definitive response that it's going to always go your way.
Yeah. You know, back to, you know, our early conversations, you know, when, you know, our private conversations.
Yeah.
You know, we've been around enough people, you know, in our careers that because of their position, they've been forced to take lives and they've been friends of ours.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've had to help them navigate through these things.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I look back, you know, we touched on in our conversation, you know, some of the things that they might do to compensate for these new emotional, you know, ties that they have with taking the life. And, you know, we talked about substance abuse and different things like that, you know, trying to help your friends from going down a downward spiral.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the reasons why with CCW Safe that we push for, most of our members don't even have to ask.
Yeah.
If they had a deadly force event, like we say, okay, listen, you really need to talk to a licensed counselor. You really need to get some of this stuff out. I mean, you know, because a lot of time you run into that second guessing.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
In your world, in the military, you know, where you're charged to move forward and you have, you know, assignments or, you know, these deadly encounters. And the police world, the same thing, deadly encounters where we're forced to do, you know, move forward. Citizens really don't have the ability to prepare for something like that.
Yeah.
Do you two agree with, like, you know, psychological training there after the event?
Well, I certainly think that you have to have a conversation about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what it looks like specifically, I think it's still, we're in the infancy of that kind of discovery. I do feel that one of the things that is very important is that the more you train, the more you are better equipped to handle that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of reasons for that. The more you train, the more you're aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when we train, we know that why we're training. We're training because we're potentially having to negotiate a deadly force encounter. We know that. So it's on the forefront of our brains. The other thing about training that brings a positive is that it helps you familiarize yourself with the context of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that familiarization helps you to manage that stress.
Yes.
It also creates what I like to call the look. And when we train people for like assault, CQB, room entries and stuff like that, what we're trying to do is we're trying to put them in a situation where they get all these looks of this space, coming at it from every different angle, right? And the more looks they get, the more familiar they are, the more accurate their decision making is under stress. And that's one of the things that is very valuable because, you know, we want to make sure that if we are forced to use deadly force, it's for the right reasons.
Gotcha.
And the more you are familiar with that, the more comfortable and confident you are through the training, the more likely you are to make the right decision, the more likely you are to make that right decision in a very timely manner.
Gotcha.
Right? And so all of that is helping to reduce stress. It's helping to manage, it's a coping mechanism that we often don't really appreciate. Like I didn't appreciate it at all when I was going through it. The thousands of hours that we would do in the shoot house over and over, runs. And then of course, the first time I do it for real and you realize, this is very familiar.
Yes.
This is not a novelty to me. This is not new. You know, gotcha. Granted, there are bad guys there and they're shooting, but this is like the atmosphere and my composure is familiar.
Yes.
And it allows me to be level-headed and more, my agility to react to the situation is higher.
Yeah.
And my ability to make a split-second decision that is accurate is higher. And it was, again, one of these things where you're like, oh, that's why we were there for so many hours, over and over and over again, pounding it. Because we're trying to instill in everybody that look so that they have the best way. And you know, you talk to guys and they're like, yeah, I mean, it felt like work. It just felt like training. It felt like what I did what I was trained to do. That's a common reaction.
That is.
It's a common response. Yeah. I did what I was trained to do. That's kind of what we want to try. It's one of the things that I tell people about that are on the fence about training.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I get it. I understand. And sometimes it doesn't fit into your world because of one thing or another. But, you know, what you get from it is so incredibly valuable. It's not just about the marksmanship. It's not just about the gun handling. It's about the preparation and that look.
Got you. I'm going to do a kind of a hard pivot right now.
Go for it.
To talk about ammunition.
Yeah.
Right? And the importance of having the right round, understanding what they do.
Sure.
You know, you came out here yesterday on range, and, you know, we got to test some different ammunition with you. Kind of talk about, because people really don't know. They just think, okay, this bullet just goes in.
Like, yeah.
What does it do?
Sure. So, you know, when we talk about terminal ballistics, there's a lot of, there's so many great resources out there that are available. And one of the things that we understand is that there are two categories of terminal ballistics, or two ways of defining them. There is the pistol, and then there's the rifle, right? So the difference between those two has to do with velocity. The higher velocity rifle rounds are way more lethal. And, you know, you look at these rifle rounds, you look at a 5.56 round, and it's 55 grain. You have to, you wonder, why is this more lethal than this 115 or 147 grain bullet that I'm shooting for my handgun? It's sometimes a disconnect there. Well, the reason why that is more lethal is because it has an additional wounding mechanism that is void of handguns, which is the velocity. Rifle rounds are flying faster than pistol rounds.
Gotcha.
So what happens is there's three wounding mechanisms that you can expect, right? The permanent wound cavity, which is bored out channel that, you know, is basically destroying whatever it comes into contact with.
Yes.
Then you have fragmentation. And fragmentation means the projectile compromises its structural integrity and parts of it shoot off radially, severing more tissue, ligaments, and, you know, neighboring tissue. And then you have the shock wave from the velocity, and that's coming in after all of this. And what happens is when that shock wave hits the body, which is the majority of our body is fluids, it creates this hydrodynamic kind of condition that just turns the wound channel and the all the other radial wounds from the fragmentation, it just turns it into goo, and it's incredibly destructive, very destructive. But that's exclusive or inclusive to just rifle rounds.
Gotcha.
Right? Because pistol rounds don't travel at the velocity to generate that. Pistol rounds really give you just one wounding mechanism, the permanent wound cavity. Now, we can sometimes increase the size of the permanent wound cavity if we change the bullet diameter or if we have the fortune of seeing the bullet expand due to the hollow point nature. That's awesome. But that's still just one wounding mechanism. We don't get the fragmentation and we don't get the secondary wounding effects of the hydrostatic shock. The faster, you know, even the 357 SIG, which was lauded as like, oh, this is going to be it. This is going to be, you know, the round. It's still pushing out at about 1,350 feet per second. We need 2,000 feet per second at a minimum to see that hydrostatic shock. So pistol rounds just don't do it. There have been attempts at trying to make it happen, trying to bring a pistol caliber round up to the rifle velocities. They just haven't been successful for one reason or another. I believe that right now there's a company that has cracked the code and has discovered a way to do this. The company's name is Simex Tactical, and they produce a hypervelocity submass penetration control round that is showing incredible performance. And it's, I believe it's going to usher in a new era for pistol calibers. It's going to change things. It's going to at least force the conversation that people don't want to have. So why is it so unique? Well, it's a 9mm. In this case, we're talking about the 9mm. It's a 45 grain hollow point that is traveling at, in this case, about 2,100 feet per second out of a ported 3.1 inch barrel. So that's a very common concealed carry gun, a micro compact pistol. 2,100 feet per second.
Making that, and that's amazing. For the layperson who really doesn't understand exactly what you're talking about, what's the benefit for that transition?
So What you get when you get that in a pistol mm-hmm. is you get a similar type of effect, of wounding effect from the rifle. So the round is going to it's going to penetrate, and in, within about 2 inches, it's going to start to dump the majority of its energy. And you're going to see a wound cavity that is going to be a massive wound cavity compared to just the wound cavity that you see from penetration only.
Mm.
That's going to probably tap out at about 8 inches.
Mm.
So you get the hypervelocity. That's what causes all this trauma. You get the submass, so the round is about 45 grains. And then you get the penetration control. So it's really only going to go to about 8 inches.
Gotcha.
Max,
yeah.
Right? So, you know, that's hugely valuable, because what does that translate to? That translates to less rounds being fired. If mm-hmm. I'm getting more, if I'm getting better results from the rounds that I am firing, that means that I probably have to fire less. Two is that I also have to worry less about collateral damage. In other words, over penetrating through the target and hitting another bystander behind
gotcha.
Or nearby.
Uh-huh.
And then the other one that we're discovering that is incredibly valuable, it's an unintended consequence per se, but due to all the science behind creating this round, what you get is you get a huge reduction in recoil control.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is that the recoil, you know, the numbers that we typically see is about 30% reduction in recoil.
Yeah.
But yesterday, talking to a lot of the people on the line, both experienced and inexperienced, and most everybody was saying it's got to be at least 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean? That means that the sight system is traveling less off the target, which means that you have an ability to fire not just faster, but also more accurately.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, translates to a quicker and more effective stop to that attack.
Gotcha.
Shorter compressed time frame, firing less ammo and worrying less about over-penetration. So hugely excited about this.
Nice.
But it's not without its... It's not without its problems, per se. And what I mean by that is how the industry looks at handgun ammunition.
Yeah.
And in specific, how do we gauge this ammunition? So right now, the standard is the FBI protocol. Now, the FBI protocol came out in the 80s as a result of a really bad shootout they had down in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And they started to experiment with new calibers, new designs, new guns, because they decided that it was the bullet's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe that's true, maybe it's not true, but it started this incredible journey about bullet design and bullet production, and it was good in that sense. It forced evolution. And they came up with a standard to be able to compare apples to apples, right? We're now going to be taking all this, you know, the ammo manufacturers are going to be producing all this new ammo. We need a system, we need a way to measure this all across the board so that we can be fair and consistent and repeatable, and the actual outside world could do it. We're not going to keep this close to the chest. We're going to share this information with the world so that other people can do it themselves. And that's what became the FBI testing protocol. Now, for those that don't know, it's basically 6 different stages. Each stage has assigned grade, and the total grade has to have a certain score point in order to be recognized as meeting the standard. And if it meets the FBI standard, many times people consider that to be a really good round.
Yeah.
But here's the catch. Of those 6 stages, 4 of them are specifically designed to penetrate intermediate barriers.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? That's like auto glass, sheet metal, internal walls, hollow core doors. The other 2, bare gelatin and heavy clothing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So 1/3 of the test is designed around a situation where it most closely matches what a private citizen would be facing in the defense of gun use.
Gotcha.
Because for a private citizen to actually shoot through auto glass, shoot through sheet metal, shoot through a door, shoot through a wall, there are some moral, ethical, and legal concerns about that as a private citizen.
Yeah.
Law enforcement and the military, it's a part of their job. Many times they're forced to do this. And so therefore, ammo companies have designed ammo specifically to defeat those barriers. And it's 2/3 of the testing is designed around that. So it's hard. So you can look at it like it's a good round for use as a private citizen. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is. But it's a round that was designed as an anti-barrier penetrator versus an anti-personnel. Does it do a good job? Yeah, it can, but you also have some other issues that you might have to deal with, which is the overpenetration. Mm-hmm. And the fact that a lot of those rounds have a significant recoil impulse in order to generate the terminal performance that is necessary for barrier penetration.
Gotcha.
Not anti-personnel, anti-barrier. Mm-hmm. So I'm asking the question to the industry at large is, do we really need to have the FBI's, is the FBI's the sole deciding factor is about self-defense use. Mm. And I don't think it is. Mm. I think the first two stages, sure. Yeah. But then, okay, we're still kind of spinning our wheels with those other four. So I'm interested in seeing new protocol designed specifically around self-defense and private citizens and how it's being used. And as we, right now, as you look at the closed circuit TV, industry, as far as all the videos that we're reviewing from the closed circuit TV, you see this type of engagement. It's at close range. It's against, an opponent that is wearing clothing. It's, mm-hmm. He's not hiding behind something.
Correct.
So, we need something that supports what we, as the private citizens, need for our concealed carry loadout. Mm-hmm. So Simex Tactical's new line of, and it's not new, it's been around for a while, but their product line is showing great promise at that. And they're also willing to be the lead, the break trail in this self-defense protocol, this new self-defense protocol. They're putting a lot of energy into trying to come up with one that is, again, also repeatable. That's one good thing about the FBI testing is that it's a repeatable test. The thing I always tell people is that there's a difference between the gelatin that is used in the FBI testing, because that gelatin has to be a specific temperature to create the right conditions to gauge the performance.
Gotcha.
There's other options, other mediums, but they don't meet that FBI standard. Mm. So I'm not really concerned about them. While I can see it's valuable, because what that allows a lot of people to go out and purchase this on their own. Mm. It's a lot easier because you don't have to keep it chilled to a certain temperature before you use it. It's also a little bit cheaper and easier to get. Mm. So it allows other folks to test their ammo themselves in a fairly interesting medium of sorts. Gotcha. But it's not the same as the FBI's gelatin. That's a very unique gelatin, and a lot of people don't like to accept that, but it's different, and it's going to produce different results. So they are interested in trying to carry the torch and be the ones that are out there, looking to create this new self-defense protocol, which I think is incredibly important for us, because we're not seeing our world getting safer.
Yeah, correct. No, that's not happening.
We're seeing it getting more dangerous. So the likelihood of private citizens needing to defend themselves is becoming more and more commonplace. We see it, in all the defensive shootings now, And that's another nice thing that we're seeing media actually at least mentioning the concealed carrier, the home defender, using their firearms to protect life. Mm-hmm. Their lives or the lives of their family members. So.
Yeah, and that's a great way to slide into some other talk that you have in your book about, preparing yourself for that urban combat, restaurants, malls, having a plan. Like we talked about, sometimes, the need, like when we talk about our children and stuff, the wife and the husband being on the same, having a plan, moving in the same direction.
Sure.
Kind of talk about, preparation, your opinion on preparation for, that flash event.
Sure. Well, the first thing is that it starts in advance, right? You have to have a conversation. You have to create what we call an emergency action plan.
Okay.
And this is no different than, in your home, this is no different than a fire escape plan.
Gotcha.
Right? What are you going to do if there's a fire in your home and you have children and you have elderly and you have folks that you have to move out of there? What's your plan for helping to rescue them, helping to get to them? We create these plans, or at least we did as a young family. We created our fire evacuation plan, and they're good to have. But you want to also consider, okay, what am I going to do if I'm with my family and I'm in public, we're at a restaurant, we're at an event, we're shopping, whatever, and what are we going to do? I think a couple of things that are high on the list is we have, like for my family, we've established a protocol that the moment my gun comes out, my family immediately moves away from me. They move to a safe spot. We've identified what cover and concealment is. They understand what that means.
Nice.
They move to that area and they do not come to my location. I move to them when it's safe.
Gotcha.
And their job is to keep moving farther and farther and farther away.
Okay.
Right? So that's a simple thing because, you know, when the kids were young, they were taught when, you know, stay with mom, number one. But, you know, they understand that when my gun comes out, mom is in charge of moving everybody away.
Do you also, because we talk about what CCW say when we give suggestions and we talk about establishing rally points as
sure,
well. Do you
absolutely.
Guys do that as well?
So that's, you know, it's sometimes a little bit harder to do, but, you know, because every situation, you know, it's not like, okay, because every time you move to a new location, okay, rally here. Sometimes you can just have a like default setting, like move back to the car, move back to a neighbor's house, move back to, you know, you can set some default settings that are always going to be critical. Like, you know, we know that if we went to a restaurant, we probably drove there. So car is pretty common. We went shopping, we probably drove there. Car is pretty common. We were out for a walk with the kids, you know, going to a neighbor nearby. That's probably pretty common. So things like that can be easily worked into your plan. You know, things, you know, there are other things like I think it's important that you talk to your family about the difference between cover and concealment. I tell everybody at the in the do not pass up concealment for cover, you know, because if the bad guy can't see you, he doesn't know to shoot at you. If the bad guy sees me and I choose to hide behind concealment, well, now I'm putting myself in danger because concealment doesn't stop bullets. But, you know, do not pass up concealment for cover, because if I have to run way over there to get behind cover, or I can just move over here behind concealment, I'm going to choose concealment.
Okay.
Very important, right? Distinction between the two. And the difference also is knowing, are you the subject of the attack? Or you are at the attack site. All right. So if you're the subject of the attack, in other words, you know, I'm going to mug you. I'm going to attack you. Different story. But if you are at this attack site, you're at the restaurant. There's somebody that comes in. They have a disagreement, and guns get brought out. You know, this happens a lot. Are you the subject of the attack? If you're not the subject of the attack, your best bet is again to look for an escape. You know, and that's something that, you know, we talk about this all the time. You know, it has to do with, you know, like, you know, never walk into a place you can't walk out of, you know, these types of things. But at the very least, know the layout, know the, you know, and that's not just because of a gunfight. That's, well, what if you're at a restaurant and a fire breaks out? Where's the closest exit to get out of the fire? Things like that are normal. They're not paranoid kind of things. They're just part of living and part of like, you know, survival. Like, you know, we're a species that has survived these millenniums because we're able to think and we're able to employ our brains and use our brains to help us get out of problems. We don't have claws. We don't have, you know, fangs. We don't have those tools that the animal kingdom has, but we have our brain.
Yeah.
And that's a huge tool. That's a invaluable tool.
You know, it's funny you talked about paranoia. You know, I used to say that on the podcast before where I would talk about being prepared and not paranoid.
Sure.
And some of the things that I do to be prepared, you might say, okay, you're going too far. But, you know, like, you know, for instance, you know, and my family used to laugh at me, but it doesn't matter what, if I'm having eggs, you know, if I'm at the restaurant, you know, of course, just like most cops, we're looking at the exits and the entrances, but I will order a steak knife. And they're like, what do you want a steak knife for? You have eggs. I said, well, I'd like to have a secondary weapon just in case I couldn't get to, or I just needed a secondary weapon.
And we talk about that all the time, you know, if you're out and about, it's good to have what we call a first strike weapon. So a first strike weapon can be pretty much anything, right? Because maybe I don't have the luxury of going to guns right away. I might need to create time and distance in order to do that. So, you know, this water bottle with the cap on can be my first strike weapon. You know, I can use this. I can throw it at the suspect. I can use it as an impact tool. I can do a lot of things with it that potentially could buy me that time and distance to be able to then go to guns if I want to. So things like that are hugely valuable. You know, first strike weapons are so important. And it can be your phone. It could be your cup of coffee. It could be a rolled up newspaper. Mm. But thinking about things like that are super, super valuable. Mm. I remember, and I don't do it as much these days, but you know, post 9/11, anytime I got on an aircraft, I would take, you remember the SkyMall magazines? I would take the SkyMall magazine, roll it up.
Yeah.
I always had a rubber band, a really thick rubber band,
and
I would roll it up and I would wrap it around the SkyMall magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would put it in the seat pocket.
Uh-huh.
And that tightly wound magazine became a very effective tool in a very confined space.
Yes.
So, you know, it's things like that that are super helpful for that first strike weapon and creating the timing and opportunity to get. We always talk about, you always want to improve your weapon system or improve your position,
mm-hmm.
right? So anything that I'm doing from a tactical side is designed around those two things. I need to improve my weapon system. So mm-hmm. if I started with a water bottle, I want to make it up to something better,
mm-hmm.
you know? And then if I'm right here and I can move towards cover or concealment, I want to make that move. Mm-hmm. I want to make that jump, if you will.
Is that kind of like, you know, when you talk about TDE? Right.
TDE. Time, distance, and exposure. Sorry.
That's okay.
Well, TDE really has to do with the shooting solution, firing solution, right?
Okay.
How much time do I have? What's the distance to target? What's the actual target exposure? What am I looking at? Like,
okay.
How big of a target? So, mm-hmm. yes, in that sense. But, you know, when you're out and about and you're looking at other little, like when you're talking with your family, you know, and this has to do with, you know, like, I feel as though it's something that we don't talk about, but you know, we have a pro word
mm-hmm.
that is a more discreet way of saying we're leaving right now, but
gotcha.
Without drawing attention to ourselves. Uh-huh. We're not like, let's go now, we have to get out of here. It's just a pro word that when this pro word is uttered, everybody stops what they're doing. They don't ask why, they don't question it.
Correct.
They just get up and we leave.
Yes.
Right, and that kind of pro word is super valuable because what that allows you to do is if you are paying attention, you see the boiling effect starting to happen,
mm-hmm.
You have an option available to yourself that allows you to take advantage of the fact that you're paying attention.
I love that.
Yeah, so a pro word that you use for the family to kind of get out and get away is important. The other thing we use another pro word for is a sign of danger,
mm-hmm.
right? And not because we don't want to attract the fact that we are paying attention and we look at you and you're dangerous, but we have a pro word that that the kids can also help to use if they see something that they think is dangerous. And it gives us the opportunity to talk to them and help them to see, okay, well, that's not really dangerous. Mm-hmm. I can see why that may be scary, but it's not really dangerous.
Gotcha.
And so we're trying to help them to understand their world
mm-hmm.
and see what true danger is
mm-hmm.
and what might scare them. And then what they can do to kind of help, you know, better equip themselves to handle what scares them.
I love that. Now, let me slide into real quick, because being that you brought it up, I like to do these pivots. But scary and dangerous.
Yeah.
Aggressive panhandler.
Oh, yeah.
You know, kind of give us some pointers on how you might deal with, you know, that situation. I know it's...
So it is a scary thing because, first of all, I saw this firsthand multiple times.
Yeah.
When I was the director of training for a beautiful indoor range in Austin, the roadways leading up to our facility were always under construction. In fact, they still are.
Mm.
7 years, and they're still under construction.
Yeah.
But what it did was it forced us to always have to use a surface street which had a street light at it, and that was a choke point.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a couple things that I tell people about dealing with this. Every time overseas, that was a normal thing. Anytime we rolled up to an intersection, we were always having to deal with. In this case, they weren't necessarily panhandlers,
mm-hmm.
but they were potential distractions or potential attackers, just
mm-hmm.
depended.
Mm-hmm.
So what I tell people is that, you know, be mindful of your surroundings, look around, right? It's very easy to politely say no,
mm-hmm.
and that's the first thing that you should always do. But one of the things I tell people is that anytime you're in your vehicle, you need to consider your vehicle as your first level of defense.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and that has that leads me to two things. Number one, it should not be you should not leave your windows down or your doors unlocked.
Mm-hmm.
Right, if you are rolling up to an intersection and you were enjoying the breeze, okay, before you get to a full stop, you should be rolling up your windows. Your door should already have been locked.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's like 101, very basic stuff.
Okay,
then the distance between you and the vehicle in front of you. You want to leave enough navigational distance so that should you have to get out of there,
yeah.
you can turn the wheels very hard mm-hmm. and accelerate out of that spot. The next thing I tell people is that when you are confronted with somebody that refuses to accept no for mm. your answer, mm. the best thing that you can do is to stop engaging with them.
Yeah.
I don't need to keep saying no to somebody.
Yeah.
I just say no once. Mm. And that I use the delivery of no in like three different levels.
Gotcha.
Right? I can use it in a kind of like calm way, like, no man, no thank you.
Yeah.
I can use it more sternly, like saying no. Mm. And then I can use it, no. You know, so I can escalate the way that I use that yeah. to help me control that situation. And what I tell people is that, you know, I'm not going to keep giving that same command over and over until you execute the command that I just gave you.
Mm-hmm.
So if I want you to stop what mm-hmm. you're doing, I'm not going to tell you, stop, move away.
Yeah.
I want you to stop, but I'm going to give that command to you one time. What I have found in my little experiment, it wasn't an experiment, it was a day of life. Every day I left work, I had to deal with this.
Yeah.
When I just gave them a simple response that was firm, no thank you.
Yeah.
That's it. And I don't maintain any connection with them after that. I go about doing my business. Mm. I either, you know, whatever, I'm not going to engage with them.
Yeah.
I'm not going to keep engaging with them.
Yeah.
And they're going to eventually recognize that the time that they're wasting, because this is the other thing, they have to understand the dynamics of the streetlight encounter.
Yeah.
So that's in a constant cycle.
Yeah.
Right? And the more they spend, the more time they spend with somebody that they know they're not going to get money from,
yeah.
the more likely they are that they can miss the opportunity for somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as they recognize that you're not going to give, they're going to move on to the next person. But what about that person that refuses to move on?
Yeah.
All right? So here's a couple of things you need to keep in mind. Number one, you're safe in your vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
All right? If you try to exit your vehicle to deal with them, I understand if they strike your vehicle, if they hit your vehicle, it's unfortunately, but it's a trap.
Yeah.
They're doing that because they want you to
draw you out.
Exactly.
Right. Mm.
Because you're safe in the vehicle, you're not safe outside the vehicle.
Correct.
Because as soon as you step out of the vehicle, you have now committed a fatal error. And that means that you no longer really have the ability to claim the victim.
Got you.
Once you step out of the vehicle, you are now moving up in that. And you know, from a liability point of view, from a legal point of view, your legal defense is getting less and less and less and less.
Correct.
So stay in the vehicle. If they use an instrument or a tool or a weapon to gain access to your vehicle, now we're talking about a different story.
Correct.
Now we're talking about you're in fear of danger or injury.
Yeah.
Or death.
Yeah. It's no longer just scary.
Right, exactly. That is now danger.
Correct.
And what I tell people is that you should have some immediate tools available for you right there in your vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If I see that happening and somebody You have an option. You can immediately go to the kinetic tool, which is your gun, or you might consider having some other tool, which is like an OC spray.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of OC spray. And, I kept that in my center console right there in the cup holder. It was always, you know, current in its expiration date. Whenever I would pull up to the intersection, I would already put it in my hand, shake it a little bit. So if they broke my window, the first thing that I would do was give them a good blast from that OC. Now understand that you're gonna get a little bit of that yourself because you're inside the vehicle.
Yeah.
And the spray is sometimes a little misty right there.
Mm-hmm.
Ask me how I know that later. But you know, that OC spray is gonna do something. I guarantee you against that aggressive panhandler, it is not the response they were looking for. And it will cause them to take a moment to readdress what's happening here.
Yeah.
You know, if you still feel in danger, that's why we maintain that distance our vehicle so that I can evac away very quickly. If they start climbing into your vehicle at that point, after you've OC'd them, I feel like you have really no choice at that point, especially if you have children in the car, if you have loved ones in the car. Unfortunately, that is a gun solution that there's no getting around, right? But you kind of work through this making that your last best option. You've tried other things.
Yeah.
You have created a system so that when you have to also justify your actions, you can say, well, this is what I did. I gave him a firm no.
Mm-hmm.
He was insistent.
Yeah.
I ignored him from that point, and he grabbed a rock from the side of the road, which there are always rocks on the side of the road,
yeah.
and he broke my side window. Or you could say, he smashed my front window. Okay, at that point, I didn't do anything. I got to pay for that, but I'm not going to get out of my vehicle for that.
Yeah.
Right? He broke my front window. I didn't do anything, didn't engage with him, and then he breaks my side window. At that point, I used OC spray to try to create some distance from him. He then charged in, dove into my window, and I was left with no other choice but to use deadly force.
Got you.
And, you know, you kind of have created a very compelling narrative that puts you as the victim, that your responses were very reasonable to anybody else.
Yeah.
In fact, people would have said, I wouldn't have gone that far.
Yeah.
You know, they probably would have they would probably say, no, I'm the second, you know, bump. That's it. That's as far as I would go. So you went above and beyond what might be considered reasonable.
Okay. Well, cool. We really covered a lot today.
Yeah, 100%.
And, I appreciate you being here.
Yeah, my pleasure.
The next time you come through, like, I really want to tap on secondary weapons.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because I talk about when I teach, especially when you're in the car.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
You know, people don't think about, you know, if your gun is here in your right hand.
No matter where it's at. You
got your seatbelt on.
Absolutely.
You're just thinking about having, you know, secondary weapons in different places and, you know, ankle holsters and different things like
100%.
That. 100%. But we're going to break away from this right now. Hey guys, this is a great talk today with Jeff Gonzalez. Please, when you get a chance, check out his book.
Yep.
Continue to follow CCWSafe.com and everything that Jeff has to offer as well.
Yep.
So stay safe, okay?